That's Jeff Buckley and his, dare I say, immortal cover of Leonard Cohen's Hallelujah. You're listening to Sounds Good. It's your midday music and community conversation program. I'm Tracy Ross, and I'm pleased to welcome Dr. David Pizzo and Dr. Christine Lindner in to talk about the next couple of films on the slate at Cinema International here at Murray State University. Welcome.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, I guess the first movie that's coming up is Soul Searching. It's the journey of Thomas Merton, and it is this Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. Tell me a little bit about Thomas Merton, a Kentucky treasure of sorts that I don't think a lot of people know about.
Sure. Thomas Merton, bit of an international man, decided he had his kind of college life in New York, first in Cambridge in the UK, and then in New York, and then had a bit of a coming to Jesus sort of instance, and converted to Catholicism, and in part of that process decided to join the monastery in Kentucky at the House of Gethsemane, and that's where he lived and spent his sort of 27 years writing about God, talking about God, exploring what it meant to be a religious person, but also outside of the world, but also a lot of his writing engaged with the issues of the time, whether it was war. He talked a lot about kind of thinking about transcendentalism and kind of these mysticism and connections. So he was more connected, even though he was in a monastery.
What is it about him that makes him resonate today? I mean, to the point where we're still talking about him. There's a movie we're going to show and a discussion to follow. What was it about his? Was it his life? Was it his works? Was it his example?
I think all of those, one of the reasons why I recommended this film was that I feel like there's a revival of interest in monasticism or in reflection of God or the divine on a more connected spiritual manner, regardless of whether or not you're Catholic or Protestant. I see that kind of being a new upsurge within religiosity amongst young people in particular. And so I think a lot of what he wrote about his experiences as being a human, a very human existence, connecting to God through the world and through just sort of writing and reflecting, I think resonates a lot with young people today.
Is this desire to get closer to God, is it a reaction against something happening currently in society? Is it anti-technology? Do you have a read on what this movement's about?
I think there's a lot of that. I think there is a lot of kind of stepping out. What does this all mean? I think there is a general wanting to understand what's going on and where God fits. I think there's a pushback against possible the secularization that took place. But I think there's also, with the cross-cultural encounters, seeing the importance of how the divine is encountered in Buddhism. That was an important thing with Merton talking about, and with yoga. And I think there's a lot of these kind of, for both positive and negative cultural appropriations or religious appropriations being integrated within contemporary American Christianity.
The film, Soul Searching, The Journey of Thomas Merton, it looks to be about an hour. How good of a job does this do at painting the picture of the man?
Well, I'm going to let that up for the audience to decide. But one thing that they can actually do is Friday night, we have the director coming to lead a discussion after the film. So you can talk to Morgan Atkinson and posit your questions about how successful he was about portraying Thomas Merton's life. And so that'll be Friday night, immediately after the showing. Already, I hope that there's a couple of people coming. Already told me about that. So it should be kind of exciting. I think it gives a pretty good overview. I think there could have been possibly some more reflection on some of the meanings of that, but again, it was a pretty it was for public television in Kentucky, so it does have that kind of wide appeal.
So the director will be here Friday evening. Will there be a separate discussion on Thursday and Saturday nights?
It'll be just like normal Cinema International. We'll have a discussion after the movie. But on Friday night, Dr. Brian Clardy from the History Department will be leading the discussion with the director for a little bit longer. Yeah.
Well, it sounds fascinating. Is there anything else that you'd like to say about it ahead of the viewings?
Well, this is actually part of a series that the Religious Studies program is co-hosting with Cinema International. So this is actually our second event of the week. And this theme for the fall term is religion and America. And so on Wednesday, we're going to be having an interdisciplinary panel discussion, what is American religion? So that'll be on Wednesday at 5 o'clock in Faculty Hall 208.
Can anybody attend?
Anybody can attend. It's free. It's open to the public. And we're definitely welcome members of the community and the Murray State students and faculty and staff. And we also have a couple of other events taking place this term. And so if you're interested, there's posters, and we'll be publicizing them on WKMS. Hopefully we'll have them on the calendar, the public calendar there.
And will you be taking questions from those in attendance at the Wednesday
Yes,
panel.
We always have questions. We always kind of try to model decorum, so we make sure that we are the model of how we want people to engage in civil discussion. But yes, we'll be answering questions and asking questions, and this will be, again, talking about what is religion, what is religiosity in the United States, but also in the Americas as a whole. So thinking about when we diversify what we think about America, that might change some of the questions and kind of perceptions we have about religiosity.
Oh, that sounds very fascinating. We're going to turn now to really a story that, if you didn't know better, you think was just a work of fiction, right? It's depicted in Joyeux Noël. Did I butcher that title? Or
only slightly.
Only well, good. Close enough for jazz. So, so tell us about the event, and then I want to know kind of how accurate the depiction is.
Sure.
Is it melodramatic, or is it true to life?
Sure. So Joyeux Noël is based on the Christmas truces of 1914. So this is a pretty famous story. It's Christmas Eve, 1914, and a German opera singer named Walter Kirchhoff, who's up in the front line. He had been touring with the Crown Prince, who was in the rear because he knew better than to be in the front line. And this guy starts singing. He was a tenor with the Berlin Opera. They all start singing. Suddenly the British and the French are singing. And before you know it, they're playing soccer in no man's land. They're getting their dead and they're injured, dragging them out of no man's land. And this fraternization goes on for days, all up and down the line in the Western Front. And that absolutely happened. It did not really ever happen again. So 1915, 16, there's so much bad blood by that point, it doesn't repeat. One thing that's interesting is, that's often left out of the story, is many of the people in the line, of course, didn't necessarily care about Christmas. So many of them were Indian troops or Algerians. Indeed, some of the first people that heard this happening were Algerians. They also joined the truce, which I think indicates it's, you know, part of it is the Christmas spirit, but I mean, ultimately, these people were so exhausted. And their officers were super, super unhappy with them. That's another reason it doesn't happen again. It's shut down pretty quickly, and, you know, people are punished. And you do see this in the movie towards the end, where there's some fallout for this happening. And, you know, on one hand, as I said, it doesn't happen again, which is sort of depressing. But that being said, you can find a lot of sort of smaller versions of this. So throughout the rest of the war, there are some parts of the front, particularly quiet ones, where people followed what was sometimes called the live and let live system, where, say, the Germans and the British or the Germans and the French, you know, there's no truce, there's no negotiation, but they just quietly both get their dead for a while or sort of don't shoot at each other for a little bit. So there is a bit of that just sort of basic sort of social negotiation that's going on that, you know, it's never official. Officers are, of course, discouraging it. Also, the Italian front was so completely absurd. There are a lot of cases where Italians were running up rock face and dying in such huge numbers, so pointlessly that the Austrians stopped shooting at them and yell at them, Italian, please, Italians, go back. This is pointless. Again, their officers are really not pleased about this. I think in many ways that's an indication of just how patently absurd that front was in particular. But it is, you know, it's this amazing story of, for a brief moment, people recognizing their common humanity and, you know, fraternizing literally as essentially equals, not as combatants.
As World War One is so far in our rearview mirror now, I just wonder, how could you paint a picture of just how stark a frontline situation was?
Sure.
For your average GI?
Yeah, of course. I mean, this that is what makes this so incredibly miraculous. You know, ultimately there, by this point, both sides had tried to outflank each other and frantically outflanked until they'd hit the ocean. So there was a several hundred kilometer death strip that on both sides had these giant nests of barbed wire. The ground between them was churned absolutely to bits. They are, you know, all the way into 1915 hammering each other with artillery. So you'll just be sitting there smoking or polishing your boots and you just get vaporized. You know, the attacks that were getting launched, and there were attacks during the Christmas truce, you know, about 100,000 British, Germans, and French probably participated, but other parts of the line it was on, and those assaults were completely suicidal and futile at that juncture. I mean, they're just running young people into a killing field who, even if they get across, suddenly have to get through barbed wire with, like, wire cutters or climb over it by dropping their coats. They get in the other trench. The other side, you know, attacks them with brass knuckles, sharpened shovels, and knives. So it was this horrifying combination of hyper-industrial, incredibly destructive warfare, and then occasionally very up close, sort of almost medieval warfare. You know, and I mentioned the officers, they're basically in the rear. You know, the people who are ordering you to do this, you know, they're aware it's not going well, but they're removed not only in space, but in social class. You know, in most of these armies, these people were aristocrats, like the Crown Prince was. So, you know, in 1915, that whole first half of the year is just one pointless offensive after another. I mean, you look at what comes after that. You know, the French take 2 million casualties in 1915 and don't gain almost a single meter in doing so. I mean, ultimately, the lines that you see at the Christmas truce barely move until 1918. So 100 years ago, right now, they were busy collapsing. Actually, we're at the centenary of the end of all of this right now. And in one level, yeah, it's removed in time. But of course, that war, and we can talk about this another time, is sort of this horrifying toxic spill that causes so much misery thereafter, whether it's Dr. Linder could say a lot more about the Ottomans in the Middle East, that chaos, or, you know, the birth of Bolshevism, Nazism, fascism. That war was sort of the original Big Bang catastrophe of the rest of the century. So on one level, yeah, 100 years ago was a long time, but it's not that long ago. And a lot of the issues that came up in that war, I mean, they've absolutely not been solved.
Dr. St. Paul isn't here, and she's the executive director of Cinema International, so it might feel awkward asking her this, but both of you have chosen to be a part of Cinema International. What is it about film that we can use as a lens to view history, to view important figures? It's a medium that seems to resonate with just a large swath of people.
Okay. I think, just to very briefly say, I think Joyeux Noël does do a good job of showing the Christmas truce in a way that me explaining it cannot get across. Mm-hmm. Just the sort of human emotion of what song does and exhaustion and this, I mean, just the amount of those Christmas songs that those cultures share. It's sort of this really intimate, amazing reminder mm-hmm. that in some ways the West was tearing itself apart. I mean, they shared much more than made them different. But I think film, just what film can do, it's manipulative, but I love it. What it can do with music and image, you know, sometimes it creates problems in terms of portraying history, but I don't think there's anything other than, I would say, music, though cinema gets to use that as well, that can really make you feel subjectively maybe just the tiniest bit of what this was like.
Dr. David Pizzo, Dr. Christine Linder, thank you both so much for coming by today and talking about Cinema International. I look forward to the discussions that will follow the films. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thanks.
We're Murray State's 91.3 WKMS, your home for music and news that sound good.
It's Tuesday, September 11th. Murray State University Cinema International presents Soul Searching, the journey of Thomas.